This is Harlef, which provides your independent television programs, broadcasting on the transmitters of the Independent Television Authority.
We grew up in the UK from 1970 to 1990. This show is all about the two of us looking back and putting bits of our shared past under the microscope. From the early 80s protect and survive, mutually assured destruction, nuclear panic, to the theme music from The Incredible Hulk,
1977.
From Wimpy Burgers to Wimpy Aurak from Blake 7,
1978.
From the Falklands War,
1982,
to Falco's Rock Me Amadeus,
1985.
We look back with fondness and bafflement, and sometimes with abject disbelief, at what it was like when we were growing up. Hello and welcome back to Growing Up with Vince and Jeremy. This is our fourth episode.
Yeah, amazingly.
Of this year.
Yeah.
It's Doctor Who Day today, 23rd of November.
Yeah.
60 years of Doctor Who. I'm going to watch the colourised version of The Daleks when I get home on BBC Four.
Yeah, I've been watching some of the old episodes. I've just watched, I'm halfway through episode two of the John Pertwee story, The Demons.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been watching Tom Baker, which is kind of my sort of wheelhouse, really. So,
yep, I've been sort of diving around all different doctors and things, enjoying it. I've got a very strong memory of November 1982 or 81, when the Five Faces of Doctor Who repeat season, first time they'd ever done a repeat season of Doctor Who, featuring the first five doctors, and rushing home from school in the dark.
Yeah.
To watch it at 5:30 on an old black and white set in the kitchen. It was the first time I'd ever seen William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, John Pertwee.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I remember how foggy that November was.
Yeah.
It was perfect for Doctor Who weather.
Yeah, perfect.
Before we start our show, which is going to be action-packed, it's the fact, the BBC Verifier fact-checker thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we can actually, can we actually call it BBC
Verifier?
Well,
no, we're not the BBC, are we?
We're not, though. No. I'm surprised we haven't fallen foul.
It's
of
the VJ thing. What have you got to fact-check this time?
Okay, so a couple of things. Well, four things, actually. Firstly, Glenn Miller, I can now confirm that he was actually a trombone player. I think I might have said he was a clarinet player.
Okay.
So that's one for you. We were talking about Flight of the Bumblebee.
Yeah.
And Vince came up with a sort of generic Russian surname.
Did I?
Yeah, but he's actually Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov.
Rimsky-Korsakov, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Slade, dates of birth.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm going with. Contrary to the number one Guinness Book number one hits.
Wow, that's the second time you've had issue with the number one book of hits.
Yeah, Noddy Holder, 15th of June 1946. Jim Lee, 14th of June 1949. Dave Hill, 4th of April 1946. And Don Powell, 10th of September 1946.
Where are you getting your information from?
Well, the interweb.
Is it a shoe shiner on a New York street?
Actually, with tonight's theme, Huggy Bear would probably be the...
Huggy Bear in some kind of dingy club.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and finally, Vince made a comment about a Barbra Streisand duet, You Don't Bring Me Flowers, and it wasn't actually... I can't remember who you said it was.
I think I said Chris Christofferson. Yeah. Chris Christofferson.
That was actually Neil Diamond.
Yeah. As soon as I thought about it, I remembered. My mum used to love that song.
Yeah.
You don't bring me flowers. Is that the only duet between Barbra Streisand and Neil Diamond? Did he write that? Who knows?
I don't know. But that's
worth looking. Let's find out for next time.
Yeah. So what we got tonight, Vince?
Okay, so later on, because I'm going first, you're going to be talking about David Soul.
Yeah.
Actor and singer, pop star from the 1970s.
Yeah.
And I'm going first with ninjas, but that's an encompassing thing.
Okay,
which I'll get to in a minute.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put 22 minutes on. That's how long I've got.
To be honest, I was wondering how you were going to roll with ninjas, but we'll find out now.
We'll find out, yeah. I have done some research. So I'm going to press the play, and I've got 22 minutes on ninjas.
As you can, snatch the pebble from my hand. When you can take the pebble from my hand, it will be time for you to leave.
This is Shogun, the staggering saga of feudal Japan. The story of ruling warlords battling for ultimate supremacy. They are challenged by a stranger from across the seas, John Blackthorne, the one man with the power to change Japan's destiny for all time. This is the opening chapter of the six-part presentation starring Richard Chamberlain and Toshiro Mifune, the epic tale of power and passion, beauty and tragedy. That is Shogun.
So, I'm using ninjas as an all-encompassing term, but I will get specific. And before I even go into the subject, I want to make a few disclaimers because there are problematic elements to this in the fact that this East Asian culture coming to the West was often ridiculed, was often parodied, was often othered to make it seem as if they weren't ordinary human beings, they were something other. Which is always problematic. The sheer amount of impressions that went round that were appalling.
Yeah,
it has to be acknowledged.
Funnily enough, actually, I did the other night. I was watching. I don't know why. I was watching Norman Collier, the guy who used to do the broken mic.
Yeah.
Thing, and he did a terrible joke about kamikaze involving him putting in fault. Well, you can imagine putting in teeth and stuff like that.
Oh no! So
that, but that was the. I'm not saying it's right, but that was back in the...
Yeah, absolutely. There was an awful lot of that.
The Dark Ages.
And, of course, there's cultural appropriation going on as well.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of dodgy material, but I'm not... I have to acknowledge that while also talk about what the subject which I'm going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up from 1970 to 1990,
yeah.
Somewhere around 1980... there was a massive explosion of ninjas.
Okay.
Ninjas were everywhere.
That differs from the karate craze.
Well, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the 70s and mainly, I think, about what happened in the 80s with ninjas specifically.
Right.
But let's start with a definition of a ninja, which is a covert agent or mercenary or guerrilla fighter from feudal Japan.
Right.
Okay. And the word actually means one who is invisible.
Okay.
Did you know that?
All right, so it could be applied to Jeremy Hunt.
Yes, particularly since they're skilled in infiltration and martial arts, including something called ninjutsu.
Okay.
Which was their martial art of choice.
Right.
Now, let's go back to the 70s, and one of my strongest memories is of my dad reading a lot.
Okay.
He mainly read books about sea warfare by a guy called Douglas Riemann,
okay.
Of which there were an endless amount, all biographies of history.
You're right.
But he also read big potboiler books like The Godfather and Jaws and all those airport big books, yeah. You know the ones?
Yeah.
And one of the ones from 1975 was a book called Shogun.
Right. Yeah, of course.
By James Clavell.
That was televised, wasn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Now, my dad read that, and I was curious about the cover, which had, ninjas and an Englishman, and I kept reading about. I was very into books, as a kid, and I always wanted to read it.
Right.
And when my dad died, we went through his stuff, and there it was. And I earmarked it to be taken back to my place so I could read it after all these years, because I had a strong memory of it. But I can't remember what happened. There was a mix-up, and it got put into a different box, and I never got it.
Okay.
And I have just remembered that when I was doing this.
Are you going to get a copy now?
I'm going to kill my brothers. Yeah. Yes, and then in 1980, as you said, it was made into a TV miniseries and broadcast starring Richard Chamberlain.
Oh, right.
And my mum watched it because my mum really fancied Richard Chamberlain.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And here's a good fact for everybody. James Clavell, who wrote Shogun, also wrote the screenplay for The Great Escape.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good knowledge.
So that's 70s. There was an earlier, shall we say, Eastern... Asian boom in the 1910s and 1920s.
Right.
Okay. Especially in fashion. If you think back to the flapper times.
Right.
People dressed in all that kind of stuff. There were songs about it. It basically came from a music hall thing as well from the late Victorian era.
Yeah.
And then in the, again in the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s. In the 60s, for example, You Only Live Twice, a James Bond film from 1967.
Yeah.
James Bond teams up with some ninjas to take down Blofeld in a hollowed out volcano off the coast of Japan.
Okay.
That's good fun. That was actually had its UK broadcast. Do you know what year?
So when was it originally released?
It was actually in the cinemas in 67.
67, and it got its...
terrestrial UK broadcast on television.
1970?
Oh, no, 1977.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Is that the first time?
That was the first time it was ever broadcast in the UK, on television.
That's a long time.
Followed by The Man with the Golden Gun, in which Bond again goes east, and Roger Moore actually has teams up with a couple of schoolgirls who were kung fu experts. Remember that one?
Yeah, yeah.
That was the Christmas Day big film on ITV in 1980.
Okay.
Do you remember that? Yeah. I can remember watching it there.
Yeah.
In the 70s, there were a big star was made of a guy called Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
After a film called Enter the Dragon by the Shaw Brothers from 1973 hit the West and was a massive hit, spawned a load of imitators in different films. Here's a problematic term for that craze called chop socky craze, which led to dozens of kung fu films in the 1970s, including a Dracula one.
Okay.
Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Right, yeah.
Then there was another book, and I remember this one as well. It was called The Ninja by a man with a brilliant name called Eric Van Lustbader, or Von. I can't read my handwriting. This will be a fact checker for you. Is it Eric Van or Eric Von? That was a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
And I remember that on my dad's bedside reading table as well. So he was really into that. In March 1981, Variety, the sort of publication of cinema, you know, and Hollywood entertainment, published an article in which they said that 14 film companies were making ninja films, including following Enter the Ninja from the brilliant Cannon Films in 1981. Okay. Now, this is where I come in, because we talked about books, but I watched a film called Revenge of the Ninja in 1983.
Right.
This is the very first sort of ninja thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
It is exceptionally violent. I couldn't remember anything about it, so I watched the trailer again this afternoon. Go and watch the trailer. It's brilliant. There's even a line where a sexy woman says to a Los Angeles drug dealer, "You've just dropped all the heroin." There are stuff you would not get away with in the cinemas because... the censors didn't want stuff that could be imitated. So, for example, throwing stars into faces.
Yeah.
The sheer violence in this film is absurd. It's massively entertaining. I don't remember anything about the film. All I remember is the gore, the explosions, the sheer preposterous of the Cannon. The Cannon films just of that era are amazing. They're just so tacky and... bad, that they're good.
We watched that documentary about Cannon Films recently.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, that was that's worth a watch.
That is definitely, definitely worth a watch. Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja made a breakout star of a guy called Sho Kashugi. I've seen a couple of his other stuff. He's genuinely a good actor. And these films tended to have a good ninja and a bad ninja, and they would have a climactic fight, usually somewhere in LA where they shot a lot of this crap. That was the first one I remember, and I remember getting it on Betamax or VHS, whichever the tape was. And this was just at the height of the Video Nasties thing.
Yeah.
So, and the weird thing was that these action ninja films were as violent and gory as a lot of the Video Nasties horrors that the government were banning.
Yeah.
But they sort of got a free pass.
Yeah, that's odd. That is odd.
There were a couple of exceptions. We're going to get to that in a moment. But yeah, 1983, Revenge of the Ninja. Please, God, go and watch this trailer. It's amazing. So, we're in 1983, and the world has gone ninja mad. the most bought fancy dress costume for kids in 1983, not an astronaut, not a cowboy, a ninja.
A ninja, yeah.
There was ninja branding on everything. Kawasaki introduced a range of motorbikes called the Ninjas.
Okay.
So ninja had now become a kind of brand word.
Yeah.
You know, it's a, we hadn't heard about it 10 years earlier. If not really. It hadn't been in the popular lexicon, but now it was. There were ninja video games. There was even a perfume called Ninja.
Okay.
And I want that. I want that to give to my wife for Christmas. And if there's a male perfume, aftershave, I want that as well.
Okay.
In late 80s came something called the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, right,
which
yeah.
Was first of all a comic book.
Yeah.
And then turned into an animated series.
Yeah.
When it hit the UK, they had to take the word ninja out of the title because, again, they were worried about violence, and they called it Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles in the UK.
Yeah.
And there was also a ban on something called nunchucks, which is that swingy thing.
Yeah.
It's like you got...
Is it connected by a chain?
Yeah, it's got a chain and you've got two handles and you swing it and you hit people with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a popular kids' toy.
Okay.
You know, a version.
Yeah.
And they had to ban it.
They also had the Ninja Turtles also had a UK number one, which might come up at some point.
You're shitting me.
No, they did. No, yeah. Turtle Power, it was called.
Oh, my God.
By Partners in Crime.
Oh, no, not by the Turtles. Oh, no. What a missed opportunity that was. Oh, man. Now, television had its ninja and... let's say Kung Fu Ninja craze, okay? We're including Kung Fu in this because we want to talk about the television series Kung Fu. This starred David Carradine.
Yeah.
Launched in 1972, it ran for three seasons to 75. This is the one that introduced Grasshopper, the name that had a billion bad impressions when you would change the R to an L, and that was hilarious. David Carradine... interesting fellow, really, from the Carradine dynasty of actors. Do you remember Kung Fu?
I do remember Kung Fu. There was kind of sort of, it started off with him sort of walking. I'm not sure what it was, but
he was a nomad.
Yeah, he was walking, and didn't he? I can't remember the premise of it.
I can't remember the premise of it. We're going to have to look it up. But there was a lot of melancholy wandering back in the 70s by these heroes. The Hulk would always wander off at the end of that theme. What was it? They were just melancholy wanderers. There was some remarkable stuff. I watched the trailer for this, the credits for this again today. Monkey from, I think it was Japan. It was renamed Monkey Magic in the UK.
Yeah, I always remember the theme tune to that.
It was mad. Very, very, very mad. Do you remember the characters in it?
Not really, but I remember it was dubbed, wasn't it?
Yes, and in the voice act for the English version included the brilliant Burt Quauk.
Oh, yeah?
Kato
yeah.
in the Pink Panther films. Miriam Margulies.
Right.
Yeah, and Andrew Sachs, who played, obviously, Manuel.
Okay.
And a very good Dr. Watson, actually.
Yeah.
That was first broadcast on the BBC Two on the 19th of December, 1980. Okay. And it ran for two seasons.
Yeah.
Then there was the more... That was mad, Monkey. It was very, very strange. Lots of magic happening. Very comedic. Very childish.
I seem to remember... I don't know if I've had a bad dream or whether this actually happened, but characters riding on clouds?
Yes. That was one of his powers. He had magic, you see.
Oh, yeah.
So he could conjure up winds and ride on clouds and turn people into animals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There was also the more elegiac and sort of... morose The Water Margin.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
No.
That had exactly the same voice cast when it came over to the UK, and that was on BBC Two from 1983.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then it was Hong Kong Phooey from Hanna-Barbera. That was first broadcast in the UK in 1974.
Okay.
That was starred Scatman Crothers.
Oh, yeah.
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 Who also sang the opening theme music.
Yeah, and if anybody out there can let us know what the word henrific means.
Is that a word?
Yeah, no. Well, I don't know, but it's in the lyrics to the theme tune, as I remember.
I remember very clearly thinking that I was clever for recognising something clever in Hong Kong Phooey, which was that he famously used to consult something called the Hong Kong Book of Kung Fu,
okay,
which was a... correspondence course in martial arts. And I remember laughing because I knew that was an impossibility to have a correspondence course in a physical activity like martial arts, and thinking, oh, I'm clever for getting that. And I must have been about six or something when that happened.
Yeah.
But that was always one of my favourite cartoons.
Yeah, that's always a guy.
It was a cat called Spot who was the clever one.
Yeah, he used to do all the...
Was it a dog?
No, it was a cat.
Ah.
It used to solve the crimes, basically,
didn't it? Yeah. He was a janitor at a police station.
He was. And a theme that seems to go all the way through 1970s, wasn't there an angry police chief?
Yes, there definitely was. Yes, yes. So the ninja craze went everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it started popping up in other stuff, like the A-Team. There was an episode of the A-Team set in Chinatown, which ends with a big fight at the docks.
Right.
As it always did, with warehouses. In the UK, popular comedians would often come on dressed as ninjas. There's one Little and Large thing where Eddie Large, dressed as, I think they're both in costume, tried. Do you remember that thing where they used to try to chop a brick in half?
Yeah.
As a kung fu, I don't know, superpower or something.
Yeah.
So there was that. Or you do the one fist thing pulled back and the other goes out and hits something.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Breaks a piece of wood in half.
Exactly.
Somebody's holding up.
Yeah. And I haven't verified this because I don't know, but I would bet £50 that Terry and June, at some point during their long sitcom career, did dressed up as either in either martial arts gear or even as ninjas.
Unless I'm dreaming it, I can picture Terry Scott.
Yes.
Doing exactly that.
And I was trying to look up the Kenny Everett video show to see if he had a character. I'm pretty sure he did, but I can't remember. But I couldn't find any evidence. So any Kenny Everett fans, do let us know if you can remember a specific kung fu martial arts ninja type character played by Kenny Everett. So there we are. That was my memories and my experiences with ninjas and other... East Asian and Northeast Asian sort of cultures, martial arts and so forth, which hit the UK with such impact. There was The Karate Kid, of course. I forgot to mention The Karate Kid from 1984, which was a massive film.
It was,
one of the big hits of the year and had several sequels.
Yeah. I mean, didn't that get remade recently?
I don't know.
Yeah, it probably is because everything gets remade.
Yeah, everything does. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as usual, I've got a quiz for you. I'm hoping you haven't... You haven't managed to destroy my quiz this month by quoting everything I was going
to
ask.
You're not going to get me to chop a brick in half or something, are you? That would be good, though, wouldn't it, if you see, if you just suddenly brought out a brick and said...
Well, was I going to get you to sort of ride out of here on a cloud, if at all possible? Yeah, I've got some questions for you, Vince.
Okay.
Okay, a ninja quiz.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a few questions. So, number one, what belt colour do female ninja wear before they achieve black belt?
Ooh, I don't know. Brown?
No, no.
White?
No.
Green?
We're going to go through.
Yellow? I don't know.
Red?
Red, okay.
Okay. Number two, why was the art of ninjutsu formed?
I have no idea.
To combat the ruling samurai class.
Oh, what, ninjas versus samurai?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's a book that Eric Von or Van Losbeger should have written.
Number three, which part of feudal Japan were the ninja mainly formed?
Which part?
Yeah.
Were they in the mountains?
Well, it's an area.
Oh, I don't know.
No. Iga or Iga, I-G-A.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that was there.
What is meant by taijutsu?
You wear ties when you do jiu-jitsu? I don't know.
Unarmed combat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is a
better... This is going well, isn't it?
Which other martial art can be found in ninjutsu?
Is it karate?
Actually, skills are borrowed from all existing martial arts.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which superhero... Or superheroes, yeah. Well, superhero actually were not skilled in ninjutsu.
Were not.
Yeah.
So I have to name a superhero who doesn't have any ninjutsu.
Ninjutsu, yeah.
I don't know. the Flash.
Spider-Man.
Is he the only one? Is
yes.
He? All the rest, all of them, including things like the Thing from the Fantastic Four, the Human Torch.
Well,
all of them are skilled in ninjutsu. Don't
shoot, don't shoot the messenger.
All right.
What is the worldwide organisation devoted to ninjutsu called?
I don't know. Ninjutsu World Federation of Ninjutsu Martial Arts?
Bujinkan.
Oh, yeah.
Bujinkan. There was a movie called Bloodsport. Which martial artist was the movie based on?
Well, the only ones anybody knows is Bruce Lee.
Right.
Probably not him.
No.
Jackie Chan.
No.
Sho Kashigi?
No.
I don't know.
Frank Dux.
What?
D-U-X.
Frank Dux?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Number nine, what is the samurai code of practice known as?
Oh, is it, Ronin?
No.
Oh.
Bushido.
Oh, okay.
And finally, ninjutsu has many meanings in translation. What is the higher order of ninjutsu known as?
I don't know.
Ninpo.
Ninpo.
Yep.
Okay.
So that... Well,
yeah, I aced that, didn't I?
Can I just say, your kung fu is not good.
So what are they called? The masters who teach... see, we should have done a lot more research, I'd say. I was more interested in monkey, to be honest.
No, I can't forget this evening or your face as you were leaving, but I guess that's just the way the story goes. You always smile, but in your eyes your sorrow shows. Yes, it shows. I can't live. Living is without you. I can't live. I can't give anymore. I can't live. Living is without you. I can't give. I can't give anymore. Well, I can't forget.
This month it's Without You by Nilsson, Harry Nilsson, but he was known as Nilsson, when he's a recording artist, and that was number one.
He never had Harry Nilsson.
No, I think he was always known as Nilsson, even from the early days. But that was Without You. That was actually written by Pete Ham and Tom Evans, who were members of a band called Badfinger, who were kind of Beatles acolytes.
Yes, they were named from the Beatles. The Beatles gave them that name, didn't they?
Yeah, they were called the Ivies. And then at the behest of
McCartney,
I think, they changed the name to Badfinger.
Was the name of a piano riff they had going.
Yeah.
Around the Abbey Road recording days?
Something like that, yeah. The Ivies became Badfinger. I think one of their early hits was a McCartney song called Come and Get It.
Yeah, yeah. Which could have been on a possible album, Beatles album after Let It Be, which has always been speculated what you'd put on there.
Yeah.
And Come and Get It seemed like one of the likely candidates.
Yeah, there's a demo of it. Paul McCartney sort of playing everything and singing.
So none of the other Beatles?
No, he just came in the studio and laid this demo down, gave it to them and said, copy this.
Yeah,
and it was a hit for them.
Yeah.
And it was a hit for them. But Harry Nilsson, recorded this and released this in 1972. And it was number one for 5 weeks from the 11th of March, 1972.
Now, is this a time where John Lennon is hanging around with him?
Harry Nilsson sort of dropped into the Beatles world on the back of his first album. Nilsson's first album was called Pandemonium Shadow Show. He was a sort of jobbing songwriter. He'd written hit bits and pieces for other people, mostly like the Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
I'd written a track called Cuddly Toy for them.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Roachford Cuddly Toy, a different track called Cuddly Toy.
Not sure I know that one.
Yeah, that's a 90s track, I think. And he was working in a bank at the time and then got a chance to record his own album, which is laced with sort of nods to the Beatles. In fact, there's a great version, there's a medley on there of Beatles tracks. And there's a pretty good version of She's Leaving Home on that.
Really?
And that got into the sort of the attention of the Beatles via Derek Taylor, who was their publicist. So John Lennon, they were all in touch with Nilsson, all friends with Nilsson, sort of right from the early days. But around about this time, 1972, it was kind of the Without You single and the album it came from, Nilsson Smilsson, sort of thrust Harry Nilsson into sort of being a real star.
Yeah,
he'd had a hit with Everybody's Talking from the
that is a cracking song
from the film
Midnight Cowboy,
which was not written by him. He's a very good songwriter in his own right. And I think
did that win an Oscar for a best song for Midnight Cowboy?
I'm not sure.
I think it might have done.
Okay. So you get to 1972, he hits his highest sort of point, really, probably commercially. But I think from that point on, he was always trying to sort of undermine or destroy his own career, culminating in the album he made with John Lennon called Pussycats.
And this was an album John produced.
That's right, yeah. In 1974, I think.
Yeah, in which he shredded his vocal cords.
Yeah. There's also, I don't know if they're apocryphal, but the stories of blood spattering on the microphone where he's like putting his voice through it, because he had a fantastic voice, as you'll hear on those songs. And actually, I think he was John Lennon's favourite vocalist.
Yeah, well, we just heard the song again, and I was saying that you can tell he's got power and he's got range, but it's so controlled and delicate in places.
Yeah,
I always think of it as a big belter of a song because of that last verse and chorus, but the rest of it is very gentle and controlled. And I think that's where the Mariah Carey version is totally wrong.
Misses it.
It just is all too big, her version, and too much of it.
Yeah. She's still wanted for murder, isn't she, of that song? She's most wanted for murdering Without You, because her version, which was a UK number one as well.
Was it really?
I think so, in the 90s.
Okay.
But yeah, like you said, she misses the point.
I think so.
Of, you know, the...
I've got a soft spot for Mariah Carey, so I'm going to be devil's advocate, but I don't think she's right for that song.
No. That's fair enough.
one of the things I liked listening to that again was how much there is, but it's all in the service of the song. There's a string section.
Yeah.
There's a brass section.
Yeah.
There's backing vocals. It's all there.
Yeah.
But that lead vocal by Harry is the king, is the star of the show. And that song really is, everything is there to support that.
Yeah, he
it's
was
good producing, I think.
He was a great singer. And if you get a chance, look out the documentary about him. I think it's called The Fifth Beatle.
Oh, yeah.
It was on. It was a BBC documentary from about 4 or 5 years ago.
Arena.
Probably, possibly, or that other thing that Alan Yentob does.
Oh, imagine.
Yeah, I think that, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, as usual, I'm going to read the entry for...
although, you know, never seem to be satisfied with their facts.
Yeah. So, well, this looks all right to me so far from what I can see of it.
I'm thinking about a merchandise range of you bringing out your own book, which contradicts everything else in the official guides.
Yeah, well, you know. It's getting near Christmas. Could be a good stocking filler. Okay, so this is the number one Guinness Book of Number One Hit Singles. This is the entry for number 311, Without You by Nilsson.
Oh.
Harry Nilsson, known officially merely as Nilsson, was born in Brooklyn, New York on the 15th of June 1941. He was, in the late 60s and early 70s, a respected and much-covered singer-songwriter, but ironically, neither of the two songs for which he is best known were written by him. His first hit, both in America and the UK, was the theme song of Dustin Hoffman, John Voight movie Midnight Cowboy. The song, written by Fred Neil, was called Everybody's Talking, and it stayed 15 weeks on the British charts without ever climbing higher than number 23.
Wow.
Without You is track one, side two, of Nilsson's best album, Nilsson Smilsson, recorded in London in June 71. It was written by two members of the Apple group Badfinger, who had played on George Harrison's All Things Must Pass album and had scored the first of their own three top ten hits with the theme tune from the Peter Sellers Ringo Starr film The Magic Christian.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Also playing bass on Without You is Klaus Voormann, who designed the cover of Revolver. But it was not the Beatles' connection that made the hit. Nilsson's Without You is quite simply one of the great pop records of the 70s.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It reappeared briefly in the chart in 1994, shortly before a new version of the song by Mariah Carey went to number one.
Oh.
This attention came in tragic circumstances, however, as Nilsson died of a heart attack on the 15th of January 1994.
Oh, God.
So there you have
it. Anything there you disagree with?
No, I'm happy with that this time.
Oh, okay.
Normally I'd find something wrong with it, but...
Can't find fault. They said it was one of the great songs of the 1970s. That's difficult to argue with that.
No, exactly. Yeah, 5 weeks at number one. It might even be the biggest. This could be a fact check, but I'm going to go for it anyway. I think that might have been the biggest selling single of 1972.
Okay.
But I'll verify that. I'll add it to my long list of verification.
Right. Okay.
And let you know next time.
So I bought in Ninjas for our fourth show. You, as always, bringing something completely different.
Yes.
So what have you got?
I've got, I've decided this month to talk about David Soul.
David Soul.
Of peculiar peculiar things have happened in that house. Mm-hmm. The story goes that the man who built it murdered his wife and a servant. And though it was never proved, it was suspected in the disappearance of several children.
Yes, it was terrible, wasn't it?
Interesting.
Remarkable, yes.
Mr. Straker.
Yes?
Do you believe that evil can be inherent in a house?
About as much as I'd believe that trees have souls.
Or perhaps they do.
Oh, you're the writer. On vacation or vocation?
I am writing about the Marston House.
But in particular, sort of 1975 to 1979, David Soul, which for me is kind of his high watermark.
My brother had him pinned up on his bedroom wall.
Really?
Yes.
What, the real David Soul or a poster?
Not a poster, but the real David Soul.
Oh, yeah.
On his bedroom wall.
Yeah.
I think it was from, remember Lookin magazine?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, funnily enough, those famous pictures from the Enfield Haunting.
Poltergeist. Oh, yeah.
I think both of them, David Soul and Paul Michael Glazer, are actually on posters on the wall in the girls' room.
Yeah, and do you think they're from Lookin?
I expect so, yeah. One of those sort of magazines. I think that was the magazine
we've
of the
got
day.
An Instagram account. We'll find them and put them up. Okay, so I got 22 minutes on the clock.
Yep.
Are you ready?
Yep, go for it.
Go.
Okay, so David Soul, born in 28th of August 1943 in Chicago, Illinois. That sort of resonates with me because my family, I've got some family or had some family in Chicago and I spent a bit of my youth out there. So I know full well a little bit about that city.
I had a dear friend who came from Illinois, so yeah.
Yeah, and he's of Norwegian descent.
Is he?
Yeah. So he started as a stage actor in the 60s. And came to national attention as the covered man. So he was basically singing wearing a mask.
Really?
On the Merv Griffin show in the 60s.
Sorry, say that again. The covered man?
It was called The Covered Man, and he came out with a mask on and sang.
Bizarre.
Yeah. And he came to national attention doing that. So he primarily wanted to be known for his singing. But gradually sort of gravitated into acting, and in 1967 signed a deal with Columbia Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
He appeared in sort of various bit parts, including Star Trek and other bits and pieces.
I saw him in Star Trek the other day.
Yeah.
Is it called The Apple, the episode?
Brilliant.
Yes.
Good knowledge.
And he has a line that goes, "What is this thing you call love?"
Is that his only line?
No, he's got. Quite I think he has a big part, but I was only half paying attention.
He was in stuff. He was in a show called in the sort of late 60s. He was in a show or early 70s called Here Come the Brides, and he appeared sort of in Streets of San Francisco and stuff like that.
Yeah, I used to like the Streets of San Francisco.
And then he was cast by Clint Eastwood in Magnum Force.
Yes, he's good in that.
But
he's one of the cops who go on a sort of vigilante killing spree.
Yeah. The period I want to talk about, though, is kind of... I was thinking about when I sort of became cognizant in the 70s, really, and started to really pay attention to stuff. And I think 1977 is a good starting point for me.
Mm-hmm.
And during that year, David Soul was absolutely massive.
Not physically. He had put on weight.
No, just, but he was kind of...
His star had risen.
He was a star had risen, yeah.
Right.
So I remember him as Starsky and Hutch in 1977... and he made, in that particular season, in Starsky and Hutch, he was in an episode called Voodoo Island, Parts 1 and 2.
Oh, God, yeah.
Which we actually managed to set through ourselves.
It's got Joan Collins, it's got the Mafia, it's got voodoo, it's got a voodoo island full of sexy women in bikinis, and it somehow manages to be appalling on every level. You'd think all those ingredients, Starsky and Hutch, the Huggy Bear, all that would make it brilliant, but it doesn't. It's appalling.
So that year, 1977, Starsky and Hutch had been running for a couple of seasons. It started in 1975, but it made its TV debut in the UK on the 23rd of April, 1976. Which again would have been sort of around about the time that I, you know, from point onwards, I'm starting to sort of remember.
BBC One, if I remember.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I always remember it Saturday evenings. Yeah. Probably the last thing I was allowed to watch before I had to go to bed on a Saturday.
Do you think it would have been before Match of the Day at 9 or 10?
Yeah, definitely between 9 and 10, probably. Yeah. I'm not sure when the news would have been on then. But, yeah, I've got a memory of it being that sort
maybe
of time.
Maybe the news was at 9 and it came on at 9:30.
Yeah, I think they were 50-minute episodes. Mm. 50-minute episodes. There were 92 of them. A pilot, Christ, plus one pilot. And actually, I sat and watched an episode two called Savage Sunday.
That's the one with the bomb.
That's
in
right,
the back of a car.
Yeah, and they've got to find it and everything like that. Yeah. So for me, David Soul is during that period, the real 70s for me, musically, with like ABBA.
Oh.
ABBA really stand out to me as a really strong memory from the 70s.
Oh.
But that particular year, he was everywhere. You had Starsky and Hutch. He had two UK number ones.
Two?
Yeah, so he started the year with Don't Give Up On Us.
Yeah, that was my brother's favourite song.
Yeah.
He used to cry at that all the time.
I know. And later in the year, he had another hit with Silver Lady.
Silver Lady. I don't remember that one as much, to be honest.
Yeah, Silver Lady is a great track.
Is it better than Don't Give Up On It?
Well, they both got their merits. But one thing I did notice about them is that they both deal with the fact that he's fucked up and he's trying to make up for lost ground.
Right, make amends.
So in Don't Give Up On Us, he's pleading with her, look, give us one more chance.
Yeah.
We're still worth it.
Mm.
Later in the year, he's a million miles from home, so he's obviously hasn't bothered to sort of stick it out.
Mm.
He's a million miles from home, but he's desperately trying to get back to her.
Ah.
You know, so there's a theme running through his singles.
Yeah, of fucking up relationships.
Exactly. And he had an album. Well, he's made a couple of albums around that time, but the big album of 1976 was Playing to an Audience of One.
What?
Or actually, his first album was David Soul.
That's what it's called?
Yeah.
Oh,
David Soul was David Soul was a sort of eponymous 1976 album, but 1977 he released.
Is his name really David Soul?
Well, I said at the beginning, David Solberg.
Oh, Solberg, right.
Yeah, yeah. So there was that. They were everywhere with Starsky and Hutch. He had the two hit singles. The Starsky and Hutch theme tune, you know, on a Saturday night.
Yeah, yeah.
It had several theme tunes.
Yeah, two, wasn't it?
Well, it had one that was composed by Lalo Schifrin. That's the early season one was Lalo Schifrin.
Yeah.
But the one that most people our age will recognise from which was called Gotcha. Yeah. So season one had a theme tune which people probably won't remember, but obviously I've just been really revisiting the first season. But the theme tune that most people remember appeared in season two and season four, and it was called Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually released or performed by a band called the James Taylor Quartet. Not to be mistaken with James Taylor, the singer-songwriter.
That would be a departure.
Yeah. So there were four seasons of Starsky and Hutch.
Is that all?
Yeah. It always seemed, you know, when you're young, it always seemed a lot longer. But by 1979, it was sort of done. But around about that time as well, David Soul appeared in Stephen King's Salem's Lot.
He did indeed, yeah, as the lead.
Yeah, and he played Ben Mears, the journalist who comes back to his hometown and finds that everybody's been sort of taken over, the place is being taken over by vampires. And we watched that recently. And
we did, yeah.
And it's actually really good.
It's one of King's best books. I think it's his second novel, isn't it?
Right, okay.
It's
from 1975, I think. Yeah.
It's basically his version of Dracula.
Yeah.
The miniseries was directed by Tobe Hooper.
Yeah.
Who'd made The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
And it's very atmospheric. It's one of the scariest things from my childhood.
Yes.
Scene of the vampire boy floating outside the window. Tapping on it.
Yeah.
Was, you know, stuff of nightmares. Mr. Barlow, the vampire itself, this big blue Nosferatu thing.
Yeah.
Is brilliant. James Mason is the acolyte of the vampire.
Yeah.
Is suitably sinister and cryptic.
Yeah, very good.
And the whole thing was very well paced, very well directed, very well, just holds up, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely worth a watch. That whole segment with the kid floating outside the window. Mm. I mean, in the days before sort of digital effects, that was actually done
backwards.
It was also done on a, they had him strapped to a boom.
Oh, yeah.
So they could sort of move him in and out of the window on the end of a boom. So it was all in the days of actually having to sort of mechanically...
Physical effects.
And it does really hold up. And it's...
And David Soul, I have to say, is very, very good in it.
He is, yeah. He's kind of like... I think he's like the equivalent of like sort of Peter Davison.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, very sort of believable.
Yeah, dependable.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Mm. Not he never does too much.
No.
He never goes over the top.
No.
But you buy into what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah, very good. And that really stands out to me. Probably, in a way, more so than...
It's weird because he doesn't feel like Hutch in that. No. Like when you watch... you grew up watching someone in a role.
Yeah.
And then you see them in something else. You just think that's, you know, that's that character now in a different thing.
Yeah.
But somehow, David Soul doesn't seem to be Hutch in Salem's Lot.
No.
Even though it was roughly the same time. He's very good at being different characters.
I don't know whether Starsky and Hutch had finished shooting and then he went to film Salem's Lot or whether there was a kind of overlap.
Mm.
But yeah, you're right. You don't... He's not... he'll obviously forever be remembered as Ken Hutchinson.
Yeah, yeah.
Ken Hutchinson.
Ken, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to come to that, actually. Back in the day, when we were at school, we went to school with a guy called Mark Hutchinson.
Yeah, bit of a...
Who was a bit of a frightening...
Bit of a tearaway.
Tearaway. And Vince, I remember you always called him Ken.
Yeah.
And
he couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, but looking back, you were taking your life in your hands.
I didn't have much of a filter back in those days.
No, but you got away with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he was kind of volatile.
He was extremely volatile.
He's probably, you know, he's probably a reformed character now.
Well, if you're listening, Ken, do get in touch.
Yeah. So
he's going to be outside your window trying to get in on a big boom. It's moving in and out.
So... that episode or that serial of Salem's Lot made its UK debut on the 7th of September 1981.
Yes.
And that was roughly the first week we started senior school together.
Mm-hmm.
So we were 11.
Yeah.
So that does have a stronger memory for me.
Indelible effect on my memory.
Yeah. And very creepy, you know.
Mm. It was broadcast over two nights, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah, and it's actually recently, it was ranked number 52 in the 100 best vampire films.
Yeah, I'd go with that.
Of all time.
There was a remake in the 90s or early 2000s. And there's another remake, I think it's been permanently shelved.
Has it?
Yeah.
I thought I saw recently that there was some news on it and it might get on Max, the old the HBO. What was HBO Max?
Yeah, maybe. It's one of those, it's lost in limbo at the minute.
That's a pity. I'd like to see that.
Rutger Hauer's in it, I think.
Really?
Yeah, before... Oh, no, he was in the other one, the earlier version.
The 2004?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Someone's in this, I can't remember. Yeah, anyway.
So that was 1979. There's a very sort of... Looking at his career, David Soul, he kind of didn't have a... There isn't a large body of work. I think I've seen... He was in about 15 films and about 30... Around about 30 TV series.
On his IMDb.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, you know, he didn't appear in an awful lot. I think his last TV appearance, or last sort of notable TV appearance, was in 2012 in an episode of Lewis.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, from 2012.
Okay.
And, of course, as well, back in the noughties, he works on He was Jerry Springer in Jerry Springer and the Opera, which is a stage play.
Okay, yeah, I can see him doing that, yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in the 80s, he succumbed to alcoholism and was involved in a domestic violence incident against his then wife.
Shit, was he?
Which I think he had to go into treatment for as a condition of not going to prison.
Okay.
So he kind of...
Oh, God.
Yeah, so he took a bit of a downwards... sort of turn really in his life, but for me, you know, that period of the 70s and 77 in particular is you know, it always stand out to me. And I think we had this discussion that we felt that he was a better actor than Paul Michael Glaser.
Yeah, the weird thing was my memory of Starsky and Hutch, because my mum used to love Starsky, Paul Michael Glaser.
Yeah.
So I always sort of favoured him.
Right.
But, and when it was weird when I came to revisit it, I thought he was bad. I thought Paul Michael Glaser as Starsky was... He started out okay, but I just think he got bored of the part and started mucking around and not taking it seriously.
Reading a bit about it, you know, he was looking to get out.
Yeah.
A couple of series before they, you know, after probably the second series.
And conversely, David Soul's doing all the work of making it grounded, believable, putting the work into being a proper, giving a proper performance.
Yeah.
Which surprised me. So, I don't know. I think Paul Michael Glaser became a director.
Right, yeah. That's right. And looking back at that sort of season, I think the season 3 credits, which I did recently, because I looked at all the opening credits to get the music, listen to the music.
Yeah.
And one of them really reminds me of that. Must have been right in the zone when I was watching it on a Saturday night, because I remember... You know, the stuff they were doing in the opening credits, and
I like watching on YouTube. People have uploaded BBC listings for the evening, and tonight on BBC One, it's just of random days are out there. I wonder if there's one for that's got Starsky and Hutch, and they always play a little clip of what's coming up in the episode.
Yeah,
and it's so randomly selected, some of them. Add a bit of the theme tune sometime as well.
Exactly. Also, the only thing about, you know, once they've solved the case on Starsky and Hutch, there's always that last section when they do something jokey.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like they get involved in something they're sort of dressed up or they're doing something.
You have to end on an upload, don't you?
You do.
Keep it light.
Right, have you got anything for me?
I've got a game for you. Boy, do I have a game for you. David Soul was not the only TV crime fighter, to bother the charts.
Okay.
There were lots of others.
Right.
The game is, I'm going to play you a snippet of a song that hit the charts.
Right.
Either in the UK or the US.
Okay.
By a TV crime fighter, not necessarily law enforcement.
Yeah.
All right. Could be a private agent. Could be. Right.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is tell me the name of the character.
Right.
Not the name of the artist singing.
Yeah.
Okay. But the character they played.
Yeah.
As a TV crime fighter.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah. Go for it.
All right. Okay. Here's the first one.
Oh, it's not Crockett or Tim.
Yes.
Is it?
Brilliant. Yes. Well done. I had no idea you'd get that. All right. Let's get some facts. That was James Sonny Crockett, who was an undercover detective for the Miami Metro-Dade Police Department in Miami Vice.
Okay.
First broadcast in 1984. The song was Heartbeat by Don Johnson, the actor.
Okay.
Who had a hit album with it.
Really?
And
that's him singing, is it?
That is him, number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100 in October 86.
Yeah, okay.
Well done.
Yeah.
All right. Number 2. I want a name of a crime fighter on telly.
Yeah. Well, that was a bit... I mean, that's Dennis Waterman from when he was in the Sweeney.
Yes.
But that's the theme from Minder.
Yes.
I Could Be So Good For You. What more do you want from me?
Well, his name's D.S. George Carter.
Oh, okay.
Right, or Detective Sergeant George Carter.
Okay.
From the Flying Squad Division of the Metropolitan Police Department.
Yeah.
In the TV series The Sweeney, first broadcast in 1975.
Right.
As you said, that's Dennis Waterman, who played Carter.
Yeah.
He had several hits, and he sang several television themes. This was his second biggest role. From Minder,
yeah,
I Could Be So Good For You, written by his wife, Patricia Waterman.
Okay.
Reached number 3 in the UK in November 1980.
Okay, yeah.
But released a year earlier and tanked. It was only after the series got big that it went back into the charts and went big again.
He wrote the theme tune and sang the theme tune.
Yes, I think that was a famous sketch from Little Britain.
Little Britain, yeah.
Dennis Waterman had quite a few albums of stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Who knew? Well done. 2 out of 2 so far. Can you make it a hat trick with our third song? Let's get some vocal.
Telly Savalas.
Yes. Name of the character?
Kojak.
Yes. Okay. So that was Lieutenant Theo Kojak from the NYPD 11th Precinct. The television series Kojak from 1983.
Yeah.
Song's called If.
Yeah.
Which was a number one UK hit.
In 1975?
It was. In the 2nd to the 16th of March 1975. Well, the incomparable Telly Savalas.
We won't drill down too much because the randomizer will find that.
Oh, one day we'll be playing it, I'm sure. Yeah, my mum loved him.
Yeah.
And when I pointed out that he was a Bond villain, she wouldn't believe me.
Okay.
I had to get a book and actually show that he played Blofeld in on Her Majesty's Secret Service for her to believe that I was actually talking about the same man.
I always, what does his catchphrase, who loves you, baby?
Oh, what does, lollipops and all that.
Who loves you, baby?
Yeah. What's that? I don't know. It's the 70s. All right, okay, so 3 out of 3, doing brilliantly. Who's this then?
Okay.
Let's get some first.
I've no idea.
No?
No.
Not a savvy, I guess. Okay. That was David Callan, agent for the section from the TV series Callan, which ran from 1967 to 1972. Or you could have had private investigator Robert McCall, otherwise known as the Equalizer, which ran from 1985 to 89. Oh, there's our buzzer. I've started, so I'll finish. Edward Woodward played both crime fighters.
Right, yeah.
Had an illustrious singing career. This is called The Way You Look Tonight, and it reached number 42 in January 1971.
Right, okay. Yeah, never heard of it.
No? Okay, we've got one more.
Okay.
So we're going for 5. Who is this?
Is that Shatner?
It is, yes.
William Shatner.
Yes, that is Sergeant Thomas Jefferson T.J. Hooker, who was a trainer at an unnamed California police training academy in the series T.J. Hooker,
right,
which ran from 1982 to 1986.
Okay.
Starring the, obviously, the wonderful William Shatner. The song is called Seeking Major Tom. There are all sorts of weird things on this album. I'll show you it in a minute.
Yeah.
It reached 131 in the top Billboard Top 100. Guess the year.
1984. 2011.
Yes. Well done. You think you got all? You got 4 out of 5 there.
Ah, well, there you go. Brilliant.
So that was TV crime fighters who had top 200 hits.
Yeah, yes. I mean, you know, not a patch on David Soul, obviously. But no. There you go.
So that was our show. We had ninjas. We had Shatner.
We had we had Nielsen.
We had Nielsen Schmilsen, and we had kids tapping on the window. We got our mate Ken Hutchinson to visit you tonight, tapping on the window to get in. Until then, I'm Vince Staden.
And I'm Jeremy Wall.
Good night.
Good night.
If you like this show, and frankly, why wouldn't you? Please rate us, subscribe, and leave us a review. All the things that will help our little podcast grow. And we'd really love to hear from you. Has anything we've talked about chimed with your own childhood? Do the magic growing up years of 1970 to 1990 have a special place in your heart? What would be your picks for 22 minutes of a deep dive nostalgic fix? Maybe you'd even like to correct us, or more likely me, Vince, on something I've blundered into. Please email us at rainbowalleyproductions@gmail.com. rainbowalleyproductions@gmail.com.